when does the semester end?
I don't have an official date. Probably like Christmas time, holiday time. So maybe another month.
Yeah, I'm starting to get nervous. I'm thinking to myself, I'm gonna screw up really badly, really quickly. Just doing well on something like that for a little while. It's like, okay, this is not gonna keep on going.
Well, like I told you, there may be some throttling involved.
I'm sure.
You're doing pretty well.
As I said, like even on the last one, I'm like, nah, this is not gonna do it. But hey, we'll see. Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 73 of the Matinee Cast. It's a movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Well, it's December. It's December. And of course, as we get to the end of the year, we start to get retrospective on what has happened over the past 12 months. And as I've mentioned on a previous show, one of the things I liked a lot about the last 12 months was getting on the road and getting to meet some of the people who I only know as Twitter avatars and voices on podcasts and commenters on my site. And in that same trip where I went to Chicago, I took a little pit stop to Milwaukee where the podcast was recorded, a baseball game was watched, and I got to meet today's guest after years of basically just being online buddies, and it was very nice to put a face with the name and to understand that the person who I kind of thought I knew in my head was in fact the person that he is. And we welcome him back to the show. He is the voice of the Row 3 Cinecast, along with Kurt and Matt Gamble, and his online writings can be found at row3.com. Please welcome back Andrew James to the show. How are you tonight, sir?
Hello, I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. As I say, like I kind of felt bad because when I was going through the notes for this show and I realized how long you'd been gone, aside from that one episode that we recorded, you've been gone for 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty epic discussion, though, that we had in Milwaukee. That was fun getting together and doing that.
Yeah, well, and plus, I think this year I might have set the record for the most guest appearances on the Row 3 Cinecast in 1 year.
That's true.
By one person, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. How many times have you been on the show now?
Four? Four in total. And like, as I said, I think it was like three within a year because I was on the two TIFF shows and then I was on the Dark Knight Rises show before that.
Right.
So
right.
In the span of 2 months, your listeners must have got real sick of me.
We are quite incestuous in this movie-loving world, aren't we?
No, but that's why I've got to leave you on the sidelines for 2 years, you know?
Right, I understand. That's
there
fine.
It is. If you want to learn more details about the guest and recording of episode 73, check out the Twitter series I call Mike and the Mechanics. You'll find those if you follow my Twitter feed today being Monday, December 3rd, or by searching hash MATM73. Of course, there will be a lot of things to come, but just before I get further into the episode, I just want to take a pause. This week actually marks 3 years that I've been podcasting. Episode one dropped, I think it was December 5th, 2009, and I just want to thank anybody who's listened to the show even once or twice. I when I first turned on the mic 3 years ago, I didn't know how long or how often I'd be doing it, and now here we are. So if you've listened to just one episode, or hell, if you've listened to all 73, I thank you very much, and who knows how much longer I'll do this, but hey, if it's another 3 years, that wouldn't be so bad. On episode 73, we'll be discussing Killing Them Softly. We'll be finding out what people want for Christmas and turn the record over to play the other side. Before that, we need now to learn more about Andrew James. This is Know Your Enemy. Well, back on Matinee Cast 27, we learned that the first film that Andrew had seen was Star Wars. The last film he'd watched at the time was The Social Network. The worst film he'd ever seen was Silent Night, Deadly Night, Part 2. The unseen classic, or essential, was Singin' in the Rain, which he has since watched, and you dug it, didn't you?
Yeah, I dug it a lot. It was great. Yeah. You mentioned 2 years since I've been on the show. It was just enough time to get it in my screening. I just watched it recently. Yeah, it's awesome.
And it was only because you knew I was going to give you heat, right?
Yep, that's okay. A big part of it.
Exactly. That's my mission in life. And the film he wished he'd made was 28 Days Later, so we prepare ourselves for round two. I feel like I should know the answers to these, but hey, what's a film that you like that nobody else does?
The Core.
Oh, no.
I love The Core. I can defend it, too. It's not just like, oh, I don't really know why I like it. I like it for lots of reasons. And I don't know. As disaster movie goes, it's silly and goofy and whatnot, but it's just so much better than all the other Volcano and 2012 and what's the one with the ice storm and stuff.
Oh, like Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, I hate all those movies. I hate disaster movies. Love The Core.
The funny thing about The Core is that the cast goes and goes, right? Like, you've got Aaron Eckhart, you've got Delroy Lindo, you got Stanley Tucci, who just does not do a bad, well, he does some bad movies, but it's I do remember I saw it once in a theater even, but mm-hmm. I don't remember a whole lot about it besides the fact that it had a pretty badass cast.
Yeah, the cast, I mean, and you didn't mention Bruce Greenwood and Hilary Swank.
I forgot Greenwood. He's like the captain too, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I just like it's Journey to the Center of the Earth, basically, and pretty unrealistic. At the same time, it's kind of scientific because nobody really knows what's way down in the middle of the Earth. So there's some really interesting interesting ideas of what might be down there and how we would encounter them and whatnot. And I loved all that stuff. It was great.
Yeah. Well, there we go. Hey, at least you own it, right?
I do.
Here we go. Conversely, what's a film that everybody else likes that you don't?
Well, when we did our show in Milwaukee, I admitted to everyone that I don't like The Godfather.
But
we'll leave that for that episode. To be a little bit more fun, I'm actually not a very big fan of Bridesmaids. It seemed like everybody was just creaming over that movie, and It's got its moments. I like Melissa McCarthy, and there's some funny stuff. But for the most part, I thought it was just a huge waste of opportunity with lots of, like, they had all this great cast of, like, seven women, and they really only focus on two of them, and the other ones are just there. And I don't know. I didn't think it was all that funny. I thought it was actually pretty depressing and kind of annoying.
See, it's funny that you mentioned the depressing, because that was actually one of the things I liked about it, is that it's kind of bleak. Like, one of the things I gravitated towards, and I think I even wrote as much, is that the character played by Kristen Wiig, she is really down in mm-hmm. life. Like, there is nothing going right for her at all. And it's that moment that her best friend gets married and says, hey, I want you to be in the wedding party. One of these moments where you're going to be front and center in front of, like, a whole bunch of strangers. And you have to watch her go through that while just everything else is coming apart at the seams. That was actually something I dug about it. Now, I know you and I are both fans of Rose Byrne. Did you think that, like, she wasn't used very well in that movie? Was that part of it too?
No. It was her and Kristen Wiig were the two characters that were mostly, we spent most of the time with. The camera lingered on both of them for the most part.
Oh, okay.
And I thought they were good. There was good chemistry there. There was potential for a lot of stuff. But I kind of went in expecting Hangover for women, and that's not really what this movie is.
Yeah.
It's not that comedic, I guess.
Well, at the end of the day, it's a comedy, and comedy is subjective, right?
Exactly.
So, what was one of the last films to make you cry?
The last film that made me cry, was 50-50.
Oh, okay.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Seth Rogen. Yeah, and it's weird. Movies, sad movies generally don't make me cry. The things that make me cry in movies are usually the really warm, loving moments, like the moments where people are being really nice to each other, brotherhood,
okay,
that kind of stuff, really is usually what sets me off. And the scene in that movie where Joseph Gordon-Levitt picks up the book and realizes his friend has really been caring for him the whole time.
Right.
Just lost it at that point.
Okay.
You know, not bawling out loud, but, you know.
Yeah. No, but I think that's the thing. If you're actually blubbering at a movie, I think it's doing something, something special all its own. I think most people, they just kind of sit there and weep silently. But, I can definitely see that. That was one, you know, yeah, I was moved a lot in that movie. I think I was really kind of caught up in it when he goes into surgery, because it seems for a few moments that he's not going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
the movie could go either way. You never know in this one.
Yeah. Yeah. And in that moment, I found myself getting caught up, but no, definitely a good one. And yeah, I certainly can't make fun of you for crying at that. That's for damn sure. In the movie of your life, who plays you?
Such an awesome question, and it makes everybody who's been on this show always says it's such a good question. And I thought about it. So I thought about it too. Decided to go a little bit outside the box, and I decided Kate Winslet would play me. Awesome.
I was saying it this week. Who did I joke would play you in the movie of the Row 3 Cinecast? Was it Carrie Mulligan?
I'd take that too. Okay. She's way better looking than I am. But
why Kate Winslet?
Kate Winslet just seems like such an everyday person, but at the same time, she's really, really smart but really goofy sometimes, and she just kind of does it all. Like, I'm thinking Kate Winslet in Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Okay.
Without being the head case kind of me. I don't know. You know, she's not like this gorgeous movie star either. She's pretty, but it's, you know, it's somebody kind of more down to earth in real life. And I thought that she would just.
She seems. I don't think that she is like. This is a complete guess, but she seems a little bit more working class, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know, very intelligent, but somebody who does not like come from money or come from well off. You know, who has worked her way up to who she is.
Yeah. Right. So, right.
Yeah.
She'll have to work on an American accent instead of the British, but otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. You know what? It's kind of reminding me of. Do you ever watch any of these? Like The Voice or X Factor or anything like that?
No, not really.
Okay. One of the things that's kind of trending on those shows is doing like a song from the opposite sex. So like a guy will get up there and do like a Taylor Swift song.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think you've kind of laid the gauntlet down. So the next person who gets asked that question, maybe, you know, maybe they should think, hey, who from the opposite sex?
There you go.
Could play.
Yeah, Kate Blanchett plays Bob Dylan in
I'm Not There,
which is a great role. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, good answer. And last but not least, what are you watching next?
I decided to finally sit down and watch the Jonathan Demme picture, Something Wild. I got the Blu-ray Criterion quite a year ago, I think. And I've never gotten around to watching it. So I put it on top of my DVD player, planning on watching it tomorrow, actually. Okay.
I'm not going to lie. I saw that when I was younger only because when it came on TV, it had one of those warnings, like censor warnings at the beginning. I'm like, yes. There's going to be something good in this.
Yeah, boobs.
Yes, exactly. And it is good. Like it was, you know, it was just, I was watching it probably before I should have been, but thank you, censor, for tipping me off.
Did you enjoy it?
No, it's great. It's if I remember correct, is it Ray Liotta?
Yep, Ray Liotta.
Yeah, Ray Liotta's awesome in it.
Jeff Daniels
is really cool, and Melanie Griffith is. It's one of those great roles that she did when she was doing a lot of great roles.
Plus, it's directed by Jonathan Demme, who did Rachel Getting Married, which was absolutely my favorite movie of that year. So
yeah, that's right too. Well, there we go. I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about it on your next show. I'm sure it'll come up. For now, though, we're going to take a little bit of feedback. It's your chance to come talk to me. Well, as I mentioned off the top of the show, it is December. I am sitting in front of a fully decorated Christmas tree. You can mock me if you must, but it's the time where we give things to other people and we get things from other people. So I asked people, what would you like for Christmas? This is actually the only time I'm going to get to talk about that before the end of the year for reasons that will be explained later. I asked people what's on their wish list. Joanna Klebis from Real Feminist said that she would like the Buster Keaton collection. Hands down, it's my most coveted item. Or a reissue of Everyone Says I Love You on DVD. She can't find it anywhere. Does that exist on DVD? Have you ever seen that one?
What's it called again?
Woody Allen, Everyone Says I Love You. It's his musical.
No.
It's not so good. I guess she's a fan. But I wonder if it's one of those ones that just didn't make the jump. Nick Hoth says, what I would like for Christmas, actually, watching Django Unchained on Christmas, as it is my most anticipated film of the year. However, I already know this won't happen. She lives in India. She says India and its censorship board are my mortal enemies. She also wants Merida's hair from Brave.
Oh, well, that's a great wish list too. Good luck with that.
Yeah, no kidding. and Django, I feel her pain because I want to see it as soon as I can, but Christmas has turned into a great big runaround. So seeing a Christmas Day movie on Christmas Day is just no longer possible.
It's tough. Yeah. Yep.
Matthew Brown from your home site of Row 3 and Mamo, of course, says, for Christmas, I'd like The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey to be as good as The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And there you go. That's not asking too much, I don't think.
I'm hoping it's better, actually.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that, too. Andrew Robinson, G-Man himself from G-Man Reviews, says the number one Blu-ray that I'd love to see make its way under my tree is Dick Tracy. I'm not sure if he's kidding or not.
I don't know. There's a pretty big cult following for that movie. I haven't seen it for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But it's never just a huge fan.
It's the way that G-Man screws with me, so I could never tell if he's being serious. He also wants the Rashomon and Shallow Grave and Royal Tenenbaum's Criterions. Nice. Too many good movies need to be in my collection, is what he says. From Twitter, Danielle Dornelis, who is at L Star, she says she needs a new Blu-ray player. Shit, that's sad.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, well, hopefully she gets one for Christmas. That'd be nice. Yeah. Here's another one that I didn't quite know what to make of. James Blake Ewing, he's on Twitter as at Cinema Sites. He wants Terrence Malick to retire. Now, he's a Malick fan, so I don't know if he wants him to quit while he's ahead or...
Well, let's give him one more shot here with the Ben Affleck movie.
He needs one more shot after that, if you ask me. But James, comment. I'd love to know exactly what you mean on that one. That's might be the best answer I got. Sam Akash from Australia wants the Blu-ray of Café de Flore. She would also love the Harry Potter Blu-ray box set and the Story of Film book, which that's I've wanted that myself, actually. That did a little run here in our local theaters, and I didn't catch up with it, so I'd like to catch up with the Story of Film myself.
Café de Flore, as of right now, is my favorite movie of the year, so good on you for that. It's put it on the biggest screen you can find and turn it up.
Yes, amazing. I totally concur with that. Jessica in Sweden at the Velvet Cafe wants one of the Moon posters that Duncan Jones has launched. Sadly, the autographed copies are sold out. This was news to me. I didn't know that the poster for Moon was hard to come by.
I didn't either.
Yeah, go figure.
Interesting.
Andreas from Pussy Goes Grr says he would like collections of criticism by Manny Farber, Otis Ferguson, or Dave Kerr. Alex Kittle, the film forager herself, wants, I assume, Blu-rays. I don't know if she has these on DVD. Brazil, Singing in the Rain, and Little Shop on Horror. Yeah, there she did say Blu-rays. She also wants Rain Boots and a Job. Power to you.
Get the job, and then you can get the DVDs.
By the rain boots. Last but not least, Alison the Nerd Vampire mostly wants books on criticism rather than DVDs. She is also hoping for Spike, Mike, Slackers, and Dykes, which is especially supposed to be one of the best movie books out there. What about you, Mandy? You got anything? You got your eye on anything that you'd like to get for Christmas?
Google Fiber.
What is that?
I'm kind of kidding, but it's Google's internet that they're putting together, like to compete with Comcast or up in your neck of the woods, Rogers or whatever.
Oh, okay.
Like it's only in Kansas City right now, but it's like five times faster and way cheaper than everybody else. But my real answer is, I think it was the last email or the one before mentioned Brazil on Criterion. Mm. I have the 3-disc, like regular DVD Criterion, but it's coming out on Blu-ray Criterion in just like a couple weeks. So I've actually held off watching the version that I have to get that. It's like the full director's cut, 147 minutes with a whole extra second disc of extra features and everything. I'm super excited to check that out because I haven't seen that for... probably since high school, to be honest.
Yeah, no, that is definitely a good one. That's one, it's been on my to-buy list forever, and now that it's on Blu-ray, I'm kind of actually happy that I haven't bought it already.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's... apparently, even the Criterion regular DVD quality isn't that great. It's not up to specs usually as Criterion does, so I'm kind of glad I waited too.
Yeah, well, I've got two things on my wish list that I would like to have. One is kind of up your alley, so I'll start with that. A few people mentioned Criterion and Criterion Blu-rays. I'd like the Criterion of Rosemary's Baby.
Nice.
Yeah, which I doing Halloween, my horror bender a few years ago, I saw that and I loved it. I thought to myself, I don't know how well that movie would play if it was released in theaters now, just because it doesn't strike me as the kind of thing that would make a whole lot of money. But back in 1970, whatever, or 1969, mm-hmm. it made a boatload. It made a lot of money. And I think it holds up beautifully. It's really freaky, really, really eerie. And as Kurt has said before, it really plays on the notion, like the terror that comes with pregnancy.
Oh yeah, you know, definitely.
So there's that. So I'd really like that one. And the other thing I kind of put out there is I would like the Blu-ray trilogy of the Dark Knight trilogy. I'd like to have all those, including Dark Knight Rises, which I watched again the other day, and I really, really do still love it as much as I did when I first watched it. I wasn't sure if I just watched it through hype goggles the first time around, but when I was watching it the second time around, I was like, no, this movie holds up.
Well, good for you. I would, I'm willing to give it a second chance at some point. I find all three of those movies are good,
yeah,
but way, way overrated. But
and agreed, you know, and that's the thing. Like, I'm not trying to convince you otherwise. It's one of those things that plays to what I dig. So there we go. If either one of those, or hey, why not? It's my show. If both of those find their way under the bright Christmas tree, I'd count myself pretty lucky. In the spirit of the next show, we're going to be talking about The Hobbit in the next episode, and that, of course, has us returning to Middle Earth about 9 years after we left. And earlier this fall, there was the news that we're getting new Star Wars films. Again, almost 10 years after the last one. So my question about these two franchises coming back to the front is, what film series would you like to see revisited? I don't care how. It doesn't necessarily have to be sequels or prequels or reboots or whatever. What franchise would you like to see more of going forward? And tell me, like, kind of what you have in mind. I'd love to know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, twitter.com, where I'm matinee_ca, Facebook, or you can just leave a comment on the site. What franchise do you want to see dusted off? That'll take us to this week's new slang, and the new slang is killing them softly.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need
Killing Them Softly is written and directed by Andrew Dominik. It is based on the novel by George V. Higgins. It stars Brad Pitt, Ben Mendelsohn, Scoot McNairy, James Gandolfini, Richard Jenkins, and Ray Liotta. And Mendelsohn and McNairy play a pair of low-level thugs named Frankie and Russell. They knock over a crooked card game at the behest of a crooked dry cleaner, which causes a crooked hitman to go and set things right. All of this is happening in the specter of the 2008 American financial collapse, for reasons that we'll maybe explain later on. Andrew James, what did you think of Killing Them Softly?
Well, first of all, Scoot McNairy, what a great name.
I know, right? He's the dude from Monsters.
Yes, that's right. From a movie I didn't think too much of. But yeah, he was great in this, however. What did I think of the movie overall? The more I think about it, kind of the less and less I'm liking it. I think for me, part of it is Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford was his last film, Andrew Dominik's, and was by far and away the best movie of 2007, at least for me, which says a lot. And so I kind of went into this with pretty big expectations. And I think on a scene-by-scene basis, I think it works pretty well. Like, if you took one scene out where two characters are interacting, it's great. As a whole, I think it really falls apart. It's kind of all over the place. It's not all that interesting. There's way too much differentiation in tone or style even that he's going through throughout the thing. And I wouldn't go so far as to say it's a mess, but definitely tonally it's a mess. And I just wasn't that big of a fan of it. How about you?
I will go so far as to say this is a mess. This is actually one of the worst films I've seen this year. I don't want to say that part of it is expectation, because even though I was looking forward to this movie, I really try to check that at the door and just go on merit. But I don't know what this film wanted to be. The first thing that I don't understand, I say it the first thing because it's omnipresent in this movie. You cannot get away from it even if you want to.
Yep.
Is the decision to have it linger in the shadow of the financial collapse. Mm-hmm. Every third or fourth scene, there's a TV on or a radio on, and we're listening to George W. Bush and John McCain and Barack Obama talking about what has happened and what needs to happen and what they're deciding and whatnot. As if it is affecting the actions on the screen. Now, to be fair, at one moment, one of the gangsters says, well, this is usually a $15,000 job, but hey, things are tight, and this guy will probably do it for $10,000. You know, I think that's the only moment where anything related to the financial collapse is mentioned at all. Besides that, there's nothing. There's no times are tight, so times are tight on crime, too. There's nothing of it. I don't understand why in the world that was chosen to linger over this movie, and you can't get away from it.
No, you can't. And I mean, maybe it's just commentary on not only crime is struggling too, but just maybe people are willing to resort to things that they maybe normally wouldn't do. I don't know about that or not, but I mean, you didn't even need to say what you were talking about. You know, all you had to say is there's one thing about this movie that just overshadows. That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
It's so annoying.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
Here's the thing. The opening credit sequence is a really – it's Obama speaking, one of his speeches.
Yeah.
Or several of them. And it's edited like really frenetically. Like you'll just get one word snippets or two word snippets in between a guy just walking through an alleyway. I kind of liked that. And I also liked the bookend scene. At the end, there's an Obama speech going on and a couple of characters make mention of it. If it had just been those two bits,
yep.
Perfect.
Yeah.
But to just keep banging us in the face with it. It's like, really? These mobsters just drive around all day listening to NPR? Like, it's... It's so dumb.
There could be liberal mobsters. We don't know.
All of them.
Yeah. You know what the other funny thing is? Okay, so this is being sold as a Brad Pitt movie. Is it my imagination, or does he really not have a whole lot to do?
Not much. Like, yeah, he's not in it much. He's good in the bits that he's in it, but yeah.
It's kind of funny because when he's in control of the scene, and he's only really in control of about four of his scenes, two of which he's making a hit – it seems as though more often than not, he's just there for people to bounce ideas off of.
Mm-hmm.
It's worse than Moneyball.
Yeah, I mean, his two longest scenes probably are sitting in the car going back and forth with Richard Jenkins.
Yeah.
And and like you said, bouncing ideas off of Brad Pitt. Just yeah. Like, no, I don't think that's a good idea. No,
and then just being a sounding board for James Gandolfini.
Yeah.
Which
I found terribly annoying. James Gandolfini is pretty good in this, but I was just like sitting there going, is there any point to this? Because he's good in it, but it's not so good that I'm just completely enraptured. I'm more like, let's kind of get on with this, guys.
I see. That's the thing. I wasn't, he might be good in it, but I didn't like that character. I found that character possibly the most useless thing I've seen in a long time, because he's brought in to do a job and he complains through three scenes and then doesn't even do the job. I'm like, wait, why did we bring him in?
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's completely pointless. if those sequences where he's having a discussion with Brad Pitt, one time's at the bar, the other time is in that hotel room, if those had been really compelling scenes, like really done well, like a Tarantino might have done it.
Or if they'd been one scene.
Then fair enough. I don't mind a kind of a pointless scene if it's awesome.
Yeah.
But it's just not that awesome.
No.
It's kind of annoying again.
Yeah. It's funny because a movie that I think I liked a little bit better than you, Seven Psychopaths, talks about why can't we have a movie where there is no violence, where the people just sit around and talk. Well, congratulations. This is that movie and it's really friggin' dull.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in the moments of violence that are in this, there's two that I can think of that are particularly harsh.
Yeah.
Are so over-stylized. It's just like, I don't understand why you're doing this. Like the slow motion thing, the ultra slow motion with the gun in the rain. And it's like, yeah, it looks kind of cool, but I've seen this a million, like in a music video 10 years ago, I saw this. It's like, I don't get if what you're trying to say, if you're just trying to be artistic. And to be honest, I felt like the whole movie was like that. It was all these moments of him trying to be artistic, and it just really wasn't working. It was just trying too hard on every turn.
Yeah, it's funny, too, because this feels like a really dirty movie. Like, mm-hmm. Everywhere they go, they're going in these, like, divey bars. They're going in these really, like, run down underpasses. I think Ray Liotta's character lives in a in a trailer. The poker game that they knock over is in the back room of some strip mall joint. It feels like he was trying to tell a story with no splendor to it at all. Like he was just looking to tell a really grimy story, which is, it's kind of cool. But then you get those moments of stylized violence and it doesn't fit. Like you've taken somebody who's in the bar that proudly serves Pabst Blue Ribbon and you put them in an Armani suit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just nothing. That's what I mean by, like, there's certain scenes that I enjoyed. There were, but they don't gel together with the next scene at all. Like, it just didn't come together in the end.
Yeah. Was there anything else that kind of stuck out for you that you wanted to bring up or anything?
You know, there really wasn't. I mean, I don't know what to say specifically. I do like Mendelsohn, I think is his name.
Yeah, he's the one. He was the one who was coked out for three quarters of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I liked him up until the point where he starts shooting up, and then that just got annoying again. But like you mentioned, sort of the rundown world, like they live in this. I mean, the opening scene is in this, like, a ghost town almost. Like, it's out in the middle of nowhere, but there's houses all over, but most of the windows have been knocked out of all of them. The roofs are collapsing. There's just nobody in sight. I'm curious where this was shot. Do you have any idea?
I can bring that up. That's the funny thing, because I've said before how sometimes I get annoyed when a movie is set somewhere like New York or LA and it doesn't need to, like, it doesn't specifically need to be in New York or LA. Meanwhile, you get something like this, which seems to be going for a specific setting, but it's not. Apparently this was Louisiana, which was going to be my guess.
Okay, that makes sense then, because there are neighborhoods of Louisiana that since Katrina were totally abandoned and basically destroyed.
You could see like the foundation of a house where a house has never been put back, and Marky lives in what appears to be a FEMA trailer.
Yep.
Like it's still got the number on the side and everything.
Then that totally makes sense. But the idea of, like you said, just trying to make a really gritty, dirty, icky, sweaty movie, like I'm fine with that, but then there's just jarring moments all of a sudden that, like, they're in a really nice hotel lobby or something, or the really over-stylized shots that are super glossy, and it just didn't make sense.
Yeah, no, I didn't understand it either. Well, I'm actually going to jump to the souvenir because I kind of have a point that I want to make and give myself some time. And I'm going to do something different. I'm actually going to choose my souvenir first.
Okay.
And my souvenir is actually the final scene. And it's not giving anything away. So if you're worried about spoilers, I don't know why you listened this far.
Well, Pulse, this movie is so predictable. There's nothing you're not going to see coming.
Yeah, exactly. There's not a whole lot of mystery to this scene.
Yeah.
But in the final scene, there's a conversation that happens between Jackie, that's Brad Pitt character, and Richard Jenkins character. His name is Driver. There's a conversation that happens between the two of them as Obama is giving his acceptance speech on election night. And it has to do with Coogan getting paid properly. And the scene goes like this. So he's listening to Obama speak, and Obama, of course, says, you know, "I don't see red states and blue states. I see America. From many, we are one." He quotes Thomas Jefferson. And Brad Pitt sees that, and he says the following. I'm actually going to read it. He says, "My friend, Thomas Jefferson is an American saint because he wrote those words that all men are created equal, words he clearly didn't believe since he was allowed his now children to live in slavery. He's a rich wine snob who's sick of paying his taxes to the Brits. So yeah, he writes some lovely words and aroused the rabble, and they went and died for those words while he sat back, drank his wine, and fucked his slave girl. This guy wants to tell me that we're living in a community? Don't make me laugh. I'm living in America, and in America, you're on your own. America's not a country. It's just a business. Now fucking pay me." Here's why that's my souvenir and why that annoys me. Because that is an awesome speech that ends an awesome scene, and it is the only moment like that in this whole movie. And what annoys me about that and why it's the thing I take away is it shows me, along with the, like, throwing out every other thing that I've seen of Andrew Dominik, it shows me, at the very least, that in this movie, he was capable of doing something amazing, and he just either chose not to or didn't see what was going on. So to have a moment of awesomeness in just a field of muck, along with being awesome, it also just pisses me off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Like, that's what I'm talking about, the opening credit sequence and that sequence that you just mentioned. If all the rest of that shit... all the rest of that stuff in the middle, all the Alan Greenspans and Obama and Bush speeches that were going on, if that was all taken out and just had this Obama speech at the end with Brad Pitt rifling off his thoughts, perfect. Then the movie still isn't perfect, but it's a much better film.
If you got these talented actors, because Ray Liotta and Richard Jenkins, they're a talented pair, to say nothing of Gandolfini. If you gave any of them a moment that's even half as good as this moment that Brad Pitt gets at the end, and even this moment, it's Brad Pitt's best bit of the film by a country mile. Mm-hmm. And it is the last thing. Like, now fucking pay me, and smash cut to black. Like, the next second, you hear Barrett Strong playing over, written and directed by Andrew Dominik. I'm like, oh my God. It's an annoying thing when you get something really, really great in a movie that's really terrible.
Agreed.
So, did you have a souvenir, like, or was it that?
No, I had two, and just in case you took one, and you did. So my other one, actually, I did really like the actual heist that happens in the beginning, the bit where they knock over that poker game.
Mm.
I really liked it because, A, they showed that these guys are not totally competent in what they're doing, in kind of a fun Snatch, if you've seen Snatch, way. I like that Ben Mendelsohn doesn't say a word throughout that whole thing, and then they're robbing all these clearly extremely influential or powerful or just majorly tough guys. Like, I don't know. I found that scene to be really compelling isn't the word. Riveting.
It's
like
tense.
Tense. Like, I kept feeling anything can happen here. Anything is going to happen. I don't know which one of these 30 guys in the room is going to do it, but something is going to happen or could happen. And I just liked the way that maybe 5 to 10 minute scene plays out, just building the intensity, the time bomb that may or may not go off I liked it.
I don't know why, but I'd actually forgotten about that. And you're right. That is a good scene. I think one of the things that actually makes that scene even better is the fact that, Frankie, the Scoot McNairy character, is carrying a ridiculous sawed-off shotgun, like sawed off to the point where you can see the shells, that is in his hand is even more dangerous than a shotgun because it's going to take him with it. He's basically walking in with a grenade, and you're waiting for something to happen with this, you know, MacGyvered gun. Along with, like everybody who's in there, it looks like somebody who you wouldn't cross, and you're just waiting for this whole heist to go horribly, horribly bad. So that's
totally
true. It is a tense scene, and that is something I wish there was more of that.
Yeah, totally. They keep putting the camera in these guys' faces and the anger that's there. One or two of them will put their hand under the table all of a sudden. And like that just gets you to the edge of your seat, and then it comes back a little bit, and then it pushes you forward. Yeah, it's just a great scene.
Well, we rate on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. So, Andrew James, if you must, what do you give Killing Them Softly?
I will give the movie 1.5.
Wow.
And let me say, this is kind of one thing that's interesting. I go on to my Letterboxd account for this.
Yeah.
People are giving it 4.5. Like on Letterboxd, it's out of 5. So people are giving it like 4, 4.5, some fives.
People are crazy.
And then other people are 0.5 to 1.5. Like, it's really divisive. People really love this movie, or they really freaking hate it. And we're kind of towards the hate side.
It's not like, it's kind of funny, like to get down lower than 1.5 for me, like that's like 30% or 32% if you're doing the math. To get lower, like down lower than that, it's got to bridge into like offensive and time wasting. And that's the thing. It wasn't offensive, and it certainly wasn't time wasting because of those moments, mm-hmm. like the card game and like that end speech and like those opening sequences. There's a certain degree of craft, and unfortunately, it's filled in with bad craft. But I do not understand. Like, I'm gonna have to, when I'm done with this and done writing about it, I'm gonna have to dig into some of these really, really favorable reviews and see what it is people love about it, because I just don't see it.
I don't either.
Yeah, well, there we go. Hey, listen, maybe you are one of those people who thinks that we're both nuts and it's a 4-star film for you or a 5-star film for you. Let me know. I'd love to hear it. Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, Facebook, comment section. Let me know. Until then, though, we're going to flip the record over and play the other side right after this. Start with me again. Now, we did this last episode and we're going to do it one more time. The film that I chose to marry up, Killing Them Softly, partially to kind of get the taste of it out of my mouth, was from 2004. It's a Michael Mann film called Collateral. It's very similar in style because we have a hitman, this time played by Tom Cruise, and he just arrives in LA to do his job, do his 5 hits, and he commandeers a cab that happens to be driven by Jamie Foxx. Now, you saw this. You didn't see this for the first time this week, did you?
No. I've seen this movie several times.
Okay.
I love this movie.
Yeah, I was gonna say, oh, you got your hands on the Blu-ray, which you said the Blu-ray looks really good.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, almost distractingly so. Like, the Tom Cruise's beard, you know, scruffle or whatever on Blu-ray is really jarring, actually.
Cool. Well, it's kind of funny because one of the things I really love about Collateral, I find it could make a different double feature. It actually makes a great double feature with Heat, which are the two really Michael Mann LA films. And the thing I like about Collateral especially is that the amazing nighttime photography of LA, like LA, to use the old cliche, becomes a character in the film. We kind of touched on this in Killing Me Softly. Killing Me Softly doesn't have that. Along with the fact that where it is not named, it doesn't really go down that road of really using where it is as part of the story.
Yeah, I mean, with Collateral, not only does he just, Michael Mann, shoots the crap out of the city, like it looks awesome, just like it does in Miami Vice. But you're right, it's used as a character, and they even, I think the movie almost doesn't open, but when Tom Cruise's character first shows up on screen, he talks about L.A. and gives a great little story about L.A. and why he hates it and what L.A. is all about. Like the scene with Jada Pinkett Smith right in the beginning talking about the traffic and where to go, like right away, L.A. is introduced to us as a character right along with all the other ones. So I totally agree with you. That's a big part of this movie.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because along with that, like a lot of the places he goes turns into something amazing. I'm thinking of, they go to a few clubs. They go to like at least 2 different clubs, mm-hmm. that really kind of have a lot of life to them. And again, that's the kind of thing those are the kinds of things that stick with you in a crime film, is not just the characters that move around, but where they're moving around through.
Right, totally.
Yeah.
Good on you for choosing this as the B-side, too. Like, even though I didn't really like Killing Them Softly, I think this is totally a great companion piece, and it shows you a similar story, kind of, in a way, just done so much better. I mean, there's even a scene in here that mirrors the Killing Them Softly where the cab driver just starts to go way too fast.
Oh, yeah.
And the hitman, in this case is Tom Cruise, is like, slow down, we're gonna get busted by the cops. Same thing happens in Killing Them Softly. And I love the comparison between Vincent in Collateral and whatever Kogan in Killing Them Softly. Like, they're both very competent guys who are really good at their job, and they come in and are forced with to deal with maybe incompetent people.
Well, they're professionals, right? That's the thing, mm-hmm. is that you get the idea of a hitman, and sometimes you get the idea of a grunt. You get some, you know, some low person down the totem pole who has not much to do with the actual person doing the job. But then you get these kind of guys, and in both cases, they're playing against type. You know what I mean? Like when we think of Brad Pitt, Brad Pitt's kind of done a few different things now, but we don't really associate Brad Pitt with Greasy, which is kind of what he was as Coogan. And right. Certainly Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise in the gray hair is just a shock as a visual period. Yep. Mm-hmm. But him in that kind of, like, he looks like a shark is what he does in this movie, right?
Yeah. I mean, the silver suit and everything. You got it.
Yeah. So it's that. Now, it's kind of funny because speaking of Cruise, the one thing I think would get a little bit lost if somebody were to watch it now is when this film came out in 2004, this was sort of a different side of Tom Cruise. We weren't used to seeing him as a cold, calculating killer. Like, he'd done some stuff that was darker. He'd done Magnolia a few years before where he plays this slime. But we hadn't seen something like this before, and I kind of think that his off-screen reputation might work against this now. I don't know. I think somebody, if they were coming into it blind, could put all that aside, but I don't really know, and I certainly know that they wouldn't have that shock factor of, holy crap, that's Tom Cruise,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah, especially, definitely. Like, I love it when people that you've seen for years as the good guy, they're a big star, all of a sudden becomes all and out villain that you don't expect. I love that. And I thought they did a great job choosing Tom Cruise to, mm-hmm. to pull that off. And he does.
Yeah. Of course, the other cool thing about this movie is, did you remember that Javier Bardem was in it?
No. You know what, though? I've seen this movie 5 times or so, and every time I always forget Mark Ruffalo's in it, too.
Oh, yeah.
Every time. Like, oh, that's right. He's in this. Movie just got even better.
Yeah.
Love
it. But it's funny because this is back before Bardem was really big. Like, this was kind of on the heels of Before Night Falls, mm-hmm. which was kind of his breakout. But you can see he's got one scene. And you can see in that one scene what he does in No Country for Old Men and what he'll do. Because, of course, this is 3 years before that. What he'll do in James Bond. And even really, in a way, what he'll do in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. It's really cool to watch a movie like this and be like, holy crap, that person's in it. And then just watch them play.
Yeah. I mean, he plays suave and scary at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
In this, yeah. Which is, yeah, I mean, you're totally right. You can see exactly, because No Country is very scary, but he's very suave in Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
Yeah.
What I like about this movie, and it plays so much better than Killing Him Softly, is the relationship between Tom Cruise and Jamie Foxx, and how that relationship evolves through the movie, and how Jamie Foxx's character evolves. Like, what I like about this is Jamie Foxx is he's not very confident in himself, even though he's clearly good at what he does too, as a taxi driver. They establish that right away. And he's not very confident. He's not really serious about the future plans that he always talks about. He can't do, when Tom Cruise gets in his cab and makes him do all this stuff, I can't. But then slowly, ironically, Tom Cruise builds Jamie Foxx's confidence. He builds it so much that finally, for the last half hour or something, Jamie Foxx becomes the hero to thwart Tom Cruise's plans. And I just like that idea of the villain actually helping the hero out to ultimately undo himself. I think that's great.
Well, it's almost like Stockholm syndrome, right? Where you start to almost like identify with your captors. In this case, he takes from his captor, well, I'm using the term captor very loosely, but he takes from Tom Cruise, from Vincent. He starts at the one point, well, when he meets Javier Bardem, mm-hmm. he's impersonating him without impersonating him.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to jump ahead too fast, but my souvenir from this is that scene. Like, not Javier Bardem's great, but there's a moment where all of a sudden Jamie Foxx just says, he just flips.
Yeah,
he just turns into somebody else, and all of a sudden, on the drop of a dime, he's a badass.
Yeah,
and he says, "Tell that guy behind me to he better put his gun away. I lost your stuff. This is how it is. Deal with it. And it's just great. And yeah. kind of from there on is where he becomes, he starts to realize he can fight back.
Yeah. And it's funny because like Jamie Foxx is one of those guys. He's one of these like man of a thousand masks. He can impersonate almost anybody. And you can hear Tom Cruise in his voice without him actually doing a Tom Cruise impression. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I do love that. It's kind of funny because that's my takeaway. If somebody were to watch Killing Them Softly and I'm telling them, okay, now go marry it up with Collateral, which I think is going to play so much better. The takeaway is that a movie like these, it takes more than just a memorable hitman. You also need them to have a good mark or a good accomplice or a good boss. Like you need somebody else to counterweight what they are. And as much fun as Ben Mendelsohn and Scoot McNairy and whoever the guy is that plays Johnny Sack on The Sopranos, who's like the crooked dry cleaner, as interesting as they are and as interesting as Ray Liotta is, none of them have enough counterbalance to Coogan, and none of them play off them nearly as well as Jamie Foxx plays off of Tom Cruise.
Agreed.
So
absolutely.
There we go. So if you're looking, I think we're saying if you want to save your money and not see Killing Them Softly, check out Collateral instead. If you didn't like Killing Them Softly, watch Collateral. It'll get the taste out of your mouth.
Can I say one more? I forgot one more sure. takeaway too from Collateral. I love the scene with the jazz guy.
Oh yeah,
I really like that scene. Like,
he's one of those guys. He's a Michael Mann dude. Like he shows up in a lot of Michael Mann's films. He's in Ali. He's in Miami Vice.
Yeah.
His name, like the actor's name is Barry Shabaka Henley.
Yeah. You see, it's just one of those faces where you go, oh, I've seen that guy in a bunch of stuff.
That guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, that whole, he's in The Terminal as well. But yeah, that scene again between them, there we go. That's a scene of people sitting around and talking that plays.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, Killing Them Softly has none of that.
Did you notice? Sorry, I didn't mean to drag this on, but
that's
in Killing Them Softly, in the scenes where they are trying to talk, and we didn't mention the soundtrack either, did you totally feel like this is somebody trying to be Quentin Tarantino and completely failing? That's what I got out of it. With a lot of that dialogue, and then there'd be these songs in it that just felt like somebody trying to copy the Pulp Fiction soundtrack.
I noticed it in a few of the transitions. I didn't notice it as like, and maybe that's a sign that it didn't work. Is if the only song that's stuck in my head is the end credit song, then you missed.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because I should be, I'm a music guy. I should be singing the praises of a soundtrack if you've done your work even halfway right.
You got it.
Oh, well. Well, that's my call, and we got a very interesting one on Andrew's flip side of the record, so come on right back after this and buckle up.
I want to work in Midtown, wear a three-piece suit. I want to hire a limo just to hear my driver toot.
Andrew James' choice for The Other Side is a film I'd wager that not a whole lot of people have seen. And even if you haven't seen it, I beg of you to listen to this discussion because things might get interesting. It's from 1991. It's directed by a dude named Tom DeCillo. And it is called Johnny Suede. And it stars a very young Brad Pitt. There's some other recognizable faces in this movie. Catherine Keener, Nick Cave, and for a moment or two, Samuel L. Jackson. It is about a young man who names himself Johnny Suede, who wants to be a rock star and has absolutely nothing going for it besides the look. You got to explain to me how in the world we got to be watching this.
The only reason is, well, because Killing Them Softly, it's like Brad Pitt at age, well, however old he is now. Well, how old is he? Looks like he's about
late 40s.
He is almost 50. He's going to be 50 next December.
There you go.
Unbelievable. Crazy. Anyway, so I got to thinking, what's the first Brad Pitt movie? And you know, immediately everybody says, well, Thelma and Louise, right? But I was wondering what his first leading role was, like where he was the guy. And it turned out to be Johnny Suede. And I went, wow, I've never seen that. Let's talk about this one. And it happened to be on Netflix Instant, so it's easy to find, at least here in the States.
I downloaded it. I found it by less than legal means.
I think that's fair in this case.
I'm going to go with that.
And I'm thinking, okay, this just looks, it's got a stupid name. It's got a director that's really done not much other than some TV shows. He did a movie called Living in Oblivion with Steve Buscemi that I remember kind of liking. But basically, he's done one or two episodes of a whole bunch of TV shows. So how good could this movie be? Well, it's not really that good, but it really did surprise me with how much fun it is and how much Brad Pitt took this role and just ran with it. It's very, I don't know how to explain, the whole movie is pretty pointless. Like, there's not really anything going on other than you follow this kind of dumb guy around as he tries to just make enough money for rent, and he wants to play in his band, and he's trying to be with a girl, and it's really just, all it is a fun thing to go back to now 25 years later or whatever and watch where Brad Pitt got his start. And I thought it was fantastic.
I was with it for I'd say 3/4 of the way, and I just I wasn't liking it so much as I was just amused to no end by how friggin' strange it was. Mm-hmm. Like it was a series of scenes that seemed to have very little to do with what happened previously. And like everything, again, it's another film that's really dirty, but a film that's actually got just enough style. Like it's, I think it must've cost like maybe 10 grand at the time to make the movie. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that went into just Johnny's apartment and some of his clothes. And probably I gotta take a guess that the hairstylist was the highest paid person on the staff.
He had to be. That was intense.
Yeah. He's Johnny Suede has this gigantic pompadour. And in damn near every scene, it goes towards the end and all of a sudden you end up looking at him kind of differently. But
his hair is like a cartoon almost, how big it is.
Yeah, exactly. I can't say I liked this movie. I was more dumbfounded than anything else. The even just the songs that he sings, I was like, what is this? At one point, the Catherine Keener character, she listens to one of the songs, and I think the first thing she says is, I don't really know what that was about, but sure. And that was kind of my feeling. I was like, I don't know what these songs are. I know you sure can't sing, but wowzers.
Yeah, I mean, that's the movie in a nutshell. I don't really know what this is about, but it's very amusing. It's kind of like, I don't know, it was like Bill and Ted's, directed by David Lynch, kind of, just absurd and done really on the cheap. I don't know. It was just so much fun to watch Brad Pitt just be stupid and do strange things. And I love the outfits.
Yeah.
He has a relationship with a girl, and then it'll just sort of kind of just end. Like, I felt like there were chunks of the movie missing as it was going along. Like, it probably was. It probably got edited way down by some studio or something. But it just felt like we're here 1 minute and all of a sudden they're married or something. I don't think they get married. But, like, I don't know. It just felt like a jumble of, a tumbling down this hill of a guy's life in about a year. And it's just really one scene and then the next scene and then the next scene, and they're painting a house, and then all of a sudden he's dating Catherine Keener, and then their band is practicing, and now they're gonna go knock over a gas station. It was just weird and off kilter, and I think that's what I actually really liked about it, because I kind of planned on being just bored through the whole thing.
Okay.
I was never bored at all.
Yeah, like it was kind of a train wreck in that I couldn't look away.
Yeah.
Like I could tell after about 20 minutes that I was like, unless this really drastically changes, it is not going to do it for me. But I don't feel podcast be damned, I don't feel the need to get up. I am fascinated by what I'm watching, but I sure ain't liking it.
And there is some like kind of darker stuff in it too. Like the girl that in the beginning, he's walking down the street and there's just a bunch of guys sort of kind of gang raping a woman. There's some brutality against women in this that was pretty off-putting.
Yeah, and you kind of got to wonder what in the world that was even there for, because that was
lynching about it.
Isn't there, if I'm remembering right? It's not even a slap. Like, there's a punch.
Yeah, a woman gets punched. And there's the first girl that he's with. I don't remember if you ever actually see her boyfriend, but there's allusions to the fact that he's slapping her around, like she's got bruises on her and stuff. And so, like, all the women in this are treated horribly.
Yeah, which, and maybe that might have been one of those things where I was like, I don't know if I can get into this. It's funny that you mentioned Lynch, because this year was my first time seeing Wild at Heart. Which,
that's a good comparison.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I had to actually call up your co-host and say, okay, walk me through this one, because I'm not entirely sure what I just saw. But at the same time, like, I think the one thing that Johnny Suede spells out for me is weird for the sake of weird is not as easy as it seems. As strange as something like what David Lynch does, or some of the stuff that really quirky Spike Jonze stuff, or Charlie Kaufman stuff, as odd as that seems, and as much as it seems like they're just throwing spaghetti at the wall, there's actually a lot of craft that goes into it. And if you do weird for the sake of weird wrong, it really does not play at all.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think that was the thing that I kind of noticed. I'm like, this feels like it wants to be off kilter and quirky, but it's just not landing.
Yeah, that's what I kind of meant by it just doesn't seem to have much of a point.
Yeah.
Like, you look at some, like, a Jodorowsky movie or something, to me that's pretty much just weird for the sake of being weird, but that is so, like, beyond weird, like, bizarre doesn't even begin to explain it. But when you try to take little weird things and graft them onto some sort of story that you're telling, that's hard to make mesh correctly. And it works when Lynch does it, because there feels like there's a reason behind the weirdness. Here, I don't know, there's just stuff thrown in to maybe be funny. I don't know exactly, and it never was really all that funny.
No. Well, some of the stuff that he said was ridiculous and made me laugh.
Some of Pitt's dialogue. That's sort of where I got the Bill and Ted. Like, he feels like a mixture of Bill and Ted, kind of.
He does. The thing is, I almost want people to see it just so I can say, "Did you see that?" You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, Misery Loves Company.
I feel like I've officially seen Brad Pitt's filmography at this point. That's the other thing. I know you either wrote a post about it at one point, or you had a podcast maybe about a year ago about, are there any actors out there that you'll go see their movie just because that actor is in it?
Right.
There are very few actors at this point. I'm on the I'll go to see anything Brad Pitt's in blind.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that, because I'm of the same opinion, but then again, the last two Brad Pitt movies I've gone to see, Moneyball and Killing Him Softly, I've come away dissatisfied. So I'm like, okay, buddy, start making a few better choices here. Or like Moneyball, it might just be me, because I think I'm the only person.
I think it is just you. Moneyball's amazing.
I think I'm the only person.
But I didn't really like Tree of Life. However, I like Brad Pitt in Tree of Life a lot.
Okay.
So.
Well, there we go. I think the takeaway for me with Johnny Suede is a real simple one, and it is that to kind of be patient with actors, because if I sat somebody down in 1991, showed them this movie, and said, "You see that guy? In 5 or 6 years, he's going to be the biggest movie star in the world." That guy standing there in the most gnarly looking gitch I have ever seen committed to film, he is going to be huge. I think that's the thing, is that as much as Hollywood sometimes wants to pluck a pretty face and make them the next big thing, sometimes these guys and these women just show up organically. They've been working for 10 or 15 years doing crap, and then all of a sudden they just get the right role and everybody pays attention. I guess that's my takeaway, is sometimes be patient with the actors in the crap.
Yeah, that's I've got a big smile on my face. That's such a great way to like picture Brad Pitt's career. It's that point of view. For me, well, this is Andrew from the Row 3 Cinecast. I was all about the costumes in this. he is like, he's very, you know, 50s rock and roll style. Like he's got his suede shoes on. He's always wearing like, what's like Ricky Nelson type outfits.
Do you notice the pompadour never goes away? Like even he could be in, as I said, like in a wife beater and a pair of you know, tidy whities, and he's still got the pompadour up.
Oh yeah, like he wakes up out of bed one morning and it's there.
Yeah,
it's great. But
the look of it. Even the women, like the women are, aside from Catherine Keener, I don't exactly know what they were like, what bohemian look they were trying to give her. But the first girl, she's got a pretty good look to her as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was really pretty. I can't not recommend the movie or recommend it. I kind of recommend it just on the in the fact that this is where Brad Pitt started, like you mentioned, and I think it's really like all his little scenes of dialogue are jaw-droppingly strange and fun for some reason. Like you said, a train wreck that you just want to gawk at.
Yeah,
it's not bad. It's just really odd that this is where he started, and I think it's great, especially. If you're in the States, it's just pull it up on the Netflix Instant and watch it for half of it. Even you'll get the idea.
Yeah, I almost want to see if I can find on YouTube or something the clip of him. He's got his little dream where he gets his suede shoes,
mm-hmm.
and it's like it's like real. I know I used the term watered down before, but it's like a seriously watered down version of the Silencio scene in Mulholland Drive.
It's really
weird. But I cannot recommend this movie. But like you said, if you're in the States and you can pull it up on Netflix, at the very least for 10 or 15 minutes, just to witness the beginnings of capital B, capital P, Brad Pitt, do so.
And I think most of you out there, if you watch the first 15 minutes, you're not going to want to quit.
No.
I really think that's true.
Yeah. I don't care what you have to do. This is worth witnessing just to say you witnessed it. Well, that's about it for episode 73 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, December 17th for episode 74. It's going to be a special episode discussing The Hobbit, and I'll explain why it'll be a special episode when you tune in. Andrew's site is, of course, row3.com, where I could ask you what you have coming up, but it seems like, you know, things just happen to fly fast and loose at that place.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. We're going to be talking about Killing Them Softly. Might try to do some Hitchcock on the next show. I'm not sure, but always good stuff. By the way, did you know that today in Canada is National Podcasting Day?
No.
Yeah.
Really?
So we did our duty.
Wow,
Queen and Country.
I'm going to have to look that up with this. How'd you find out about that?
It was on a tech pod, This Week in Tech. I was listening to it and they mentioned it.
Huh, that's great. Like you said, we did our duty. That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Over at Roll 3, Kurt's doing helped out with the Substream guys and did a podcast on the Wachowskis called Very Important Dudes and Dudettes in Cinema History. And
that's true.
So you can find that over there. We got a nice long negative review of Killing Them Softly you can check out.
Is that you're doing?
Nope. I borrowed it from a guy from another site who gave it to me with good tidings to all.
That works. If people want to follow you on Twitter?
My personal account is Andrew_James.
And people can also follow at Row3 on Twitter as well if they want. As I said, all the fast and loose goings on that happen at that site.
Mm-hmm.
My site is thematinee.ca. For more podcasting content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Blueberry, the iTunes Music Store, the iPhone Music app, Listen. They all give you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Killing Them Softly, Johnny Suede, or Collateral, Also, the feedback question for this episode, which was what franchises you want to see revisited, let me know. Ryan@thematinee.ca, Facebook, which is facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, where I'm matinee_CA. Any final thoughts, sir?
No, I'm excited to hear the feedback, though, on the franchises being revisited. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but...
I'm sure it's something that if we were thinking about it for like 5 minutes, we could probably come up with. But yeah, like you said, I'm always interested to hear what people have to say on those things. Well, for Andrew, I'm Ryan, and we'll see you at the matinee.
Cheers. Your Dalek Factory will find me in the matinee.